Founders Ramble. Stories from entrepreneurs, how they started, why they started, and where they're going next. Brought to you by the Ministry of Startups.
Hello and welcome to the new podcast, which hasn't got a name yet. So Ben, since it's your idea.
Founders Ramble. Stories from entrepreneurs, how they started, why they started, and where they're going next. Brought to you by the Ministry of Startups.
Where we get together two guys that have started something up and found out how they started it up and was it a good idea? Are they making money? Are they happy? How's their sex life? That type, no, probably not that bit. It's going to be a bit of a giggle. We're currently drinking beer, which always makes it easier. And actually, I have to say, one of our candidates is a very good boy and he is going to the gym afterwards. So he is remaining sober. I've done my best to twist his arm. Who am I talking to? First of all, his name is Andrew White. He is the CEO of a company called FundApps. FundApps. You can find out more at fundapps.co. And across the table from him, we have Ben O'Brien. He is the founder, I believe, and the CEO of sourcedmarket.com. What are they? Who are they? What's going on? And why do we care? Well, let's find out. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
So let's start with you, Ben. Ben, what does Sourced do and how did this come about?
Sourced Market is a market-inspired retail and all-day dining concept. We started because I lived on Borough Market completely by chance, really, from 2002 to kind of 2005. At that point, I worked in the music business, had a small artist management company, a little record label, but I used to spend a lot of time working from home, aka hanging out at the market, eating and drinking, whilst avoiding difficult bits of work. And over that time, got to know quite a lot of traders at the market, and my interest in food shifted a little bit more from greedy consumer to somebody who maybe knew a little bit more about what it took to get good food from field to fork. And over a period of a year or two, I guess, of moaning about how shite the food was at music festivals, I eventually sucked up the courage to persuade a few traders that I'd gotten to know and a few people that they knew to get on the road for a weekend and set up camp in a field and do the food at a music festival.
Yeah, which it did used to be really bad, didn't it? Because I remember going to Glastonbury for the first time, 20 odd years ago. I'm 96. And when I got there, I was like, it's just crap in a bucket, you know. Well, that was the toilets, but it was also very much the food. And there wasn't a lot of interest. But now when you go to a music festival, it's chorizo on a ciabatta bun with sun-dried tomatoes and stuff like that. What has been part of that change? I mean, obviously you have, but what's happened?
It's interesting because, when I first started going to music festivals, food wasn't really on the menu, no pun intended. But
no pun intended, but it should have been because it was really good. You should intend more of those.
I don't know. I guess there became more and more music festivals and people's interest. I guess when I was in my 20s, like, what was cool was being in the music industry and nobody really was interested in being a chef or being in food.
Right.
You know, going out to restaurants was something your parents did, really.
So was it some of the Gordon Ramsay factor and how food became cooler in general?
I think it just became more of a universal thing. And the big thing is obviously being street food. Street food has democratized food because you can have good food without having to shell out a kind of a significant amount of money going to a restaurant with white linen tablecloths served by waiters in dicky bows. And that's been a big change. Obviously, the street food movement to some extent started at music festivals, and we were there at the beginning for that, which was really exciting because we got to know a bunch of kind of some young, some older people that were making great food. And didn't really have necessarily a lot of avenues to market. So they were trading like a couple of days a week at what markets were there. So going to a music festival was a great opportunity to get their product out there and, you know, maybe even start building the brand in some cases. I mean, Pie Minister is quite a well-known pie company these days that pretty much started at music festivals and built their brand that way. And others have done it to different degrees.
Now, how many people do you employ and what have you got?
So now we kind of did street food at music festivals really for a couple of summers, you know, and I did my fair share of mud and digging things out of mud and trying to build stores and lugging boxes of coconuts across fields and all sorts of other fun stuff that I'm glad I don't have to do anymore. And then over that period of time, I actually moved out. I moved into Hackney, where I live now, where I no longer suddenly had Borough Market on my doorstep. And from a food perspective, I came crashing down to earth with a bang, because my options suddenly went to a Tesco Metro and the local corner shop. And that was where the idea came to do a permanent source market. So the idea being to take everything that's great about a really good market like Borough, in terms of the calibre of product, their provenance, some of the atmosphere that you get when you shop at a market, and some of the experience of shopping somewhere where people actually know about the products that they're selling, unlike Tesco Metro, and deliver it in a more accessible format. So more
other crap supermarkets are available.
Other crap supermarkets are available.
Sainsbury's is also
ABC,
got awful.
Is it? We can slag people.
But you have to slag everyone.
Oh, okay. I haven't got time for that. 10 minutes. And yeah, so then we opened our first permanent site inside St Pancras Station.
Oh, that was a gutsy move. Let's just stop there for a minute. That sounds expensive.
Baptism by fire, maybe, would be a good way of summing it up. To be honest, because I knew nothing about retail, naivety was probably a very important factor in my early success. Yeah. But also it could have very easily led to my early demise. So I guess it's, you know, it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Coming into something with an open mind and fresh ideas, as opposed to experience of the, you know, the sector that you're going into. A couple of things kind of went in my favour. Obviously, getting a prime piece of retail inside a major train station is not necessarily straightforward, but the economy had just tanked at the end of 2008, and any of the big players were taking a step back and watching from the sidelines whilst it played out to some extent. So that maybe reduced the amount of competition, and yeah, so I had probably a bit of luck, bit of good timing, and we got the site, unfortunately, made it a success, and that's obviously launched the business in a much bigger way than maybe if we'd started off with somewhere less busy.
That's one of the problems, isn't it, for a lot of people. They think, well, I'd like to start in a station, but unless you've got the benefit of an economic collapse at the time, then it's
a lot easier now, because back there, I think I don't know this for a fact, but as far as I'm aware, we were the first independent retailer to get a unit within a major train station, and quite possibly the first startup retailer.
Really? Oh.
We had no track record at the time. We had the events business, but it wasn't.
It was your landlord, Network Rail.
Well, it was actually High Speed 1, because St Pancras is slightly different to all the other train stations in the country. So it's operated by Network Rail, but it's ultimately owned by a different company, which also slightly helped. But now, because of the success of St Pancras, they've taken a much more interesting approach to retail at other stations, which to some extent mirrors the change in people's attitude to food and drink. So you will find better quality, more interesting. You know, back in 2007, it was Upper Crust and Starbucks was as good as it was going to get. And now, if you're in St Pancras, you've got Fortnum and Mason's, you've got John Lewis, you've got the Champagne Bar. So it's a whole different world to what it was.
And when you built that shop, which I think would be fair to call a permanent, a high-end market, would that be fair?
Yeah, it's a permanent market.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of retail, which is the same sort of retail that you find at the market, but you can also eat and drink there as
Got it. So when you built that was the start, and now, fast forwarding to 2017.
So we just opened our fourth site in Barbican about a month ago. We're about 120 people, I guess, now.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Scary stuff. Now then, gentlemen, I should ask you... I'll cut this bit out, don't worry. I'll be doing edits. It's a bit weird. Now then, gentlemen. Andrew, you are, aside from being a beautiful man...
And your cousin.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say, there's some kind of relationship going on here. There's too much banter.
I'm his cousin, and I'm called Vinny, and yeah, he's been dining out for years on This Is My Cousin Vinny. Which, by the way, doesn't work that well anymore, because a lot of millennials haven't seen it.
Haven't a fucking clue.
Yeah. So, if you are under 25 and you don't know what we're talking about,
IMDb.
Good.
Don't
worry about it. It's a terrible film. Yeah. I don't want any association with it.
You do look like Joe Pesci, though.
Yeah. About his height. he's my cousin, and he's Irish, and I thought we'd get that out of the way. Yeah, it's not his fault.
Shocker.
And yeah, I've known him for a while. We met in Thailand, actually.
We did.
Which is weird. Englishman and an Irishman met in Thailand.
You're a lady at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, it was many years ago.
Called Vanessa.
Yeah.
You got a question, Veneer?
Oh, no, I forgot. You run FundApps. What does FundApps do, Andrew? And why are you so damn good at it?
FundApps provides compliance as a service to financial institutions. That sounds pretty fucking high level, but it simply means that rather than doing all the financial compliance and regulatory things that they have to do in Excel or whatever else they do, they send us their data and we do it for them.
So if Bob and Rajesh are doing trades across the intertubes and they're both working for a bank and there's lots of compliance and rules that might quite frequently change, are you the guy to fix this problem?
Bob and Rajesh should come talk to me.
Yeah, so they are. That's a direct, quite finite niche call out to anyone called Bob or Rajesh. But the point is that there are billions on billions of internet-based transactions going on from various banks that have to observe such things as trade embargoes, for example, and compliance rules that involve tax things. And if they get them wrong, you can see I work in the industry, tax things. But if they get them wrong, obviously, then they'll be fine. So in a sense, you could argue that it's quite a good investment to invest in compliance software. That's the backstory. Now, let's speed through your little lovely life. When did it start and how did it start?
I cheated. In my previous life, I did something similar for a smallish company, but we had an on-premise, as they call it, software that did roughly the same. But the biggest problem with on-premise software is that every single bank in the world needs to buy it and install it and maintain it and hire legions of people to keep it up and running. So we said, okay, how about we put it on the cloud? The cloud was coming when we started, so we set up in 2010 to basically take all the on-premise software, put it on the cloud, and actually hire up a team of people that would actually code the regulations for the customer rather than every single customer have to code the regulation themselves, because it is quite simple. Regulation applies to everybody equally. Doesn't matter if you're Barclays or Lloyd's or whoever it is, the regulation applies to both of them the same way. Mm. But in this, up until we came along, they were both interpreting and coding the same regulation. So we basically have a team that do that.
And success?
I would like to think so. So unusually for startups, we've taken no funding, not a penny, so we're bootstrapped. Secondly, as a startup, also quite unusual that we sell to the world's largest financial institutions. So our customers are literally the world's biggest hedge funds, the world's largest asset managers, high street banks. So we sell to pretty much your kind of blue chip companies out there. And we started off as on my own. My co-founder joined me soon after. We hired a few people thereafter, but we were literally four or five people in East London selling to some of the world's largest institutions.
Before that, it was just you sitting on a bed with a laptop.
I was in my underpants coding, as I did at the time.
And he still does. And his employees find it very off-putting. But my God, they're hard workers.
I still like to code in underpants. We founded 2010. 7 years later, we are now 32 employees, 30 customers around the world, and growing pretty much 70% year on year.
And when you say customers, you mean customers. Like you said earlier, you mean proper blue chip banks.
Proper, you see them on the side of taxis and on the roofs of airports and all that kind of thing.
When Ben was talking earlier, Ben O'Brien of Sourced Market was talking earlier, and we were talking about his fight or flight beginnings. Did that resonate with you? Can you remember the day when you thought, oh, I might be biting off a bit more than I can chew here?
I think every founder does. I think the main point as a bootstrap startup is you don't have the cash to dick around, shall we say, in high English. You have to sell quickly, otherwise your money runs out.
Mm.
So some of those decisions you make early on are incredibly important. The decisions that keep you up late at night, do I do X or do I do Y? If I do X, how long can I do X for until, you know, there's no money? So you make a lot of decisions early on. Some of the decisions we made meant that we had no money in our bank account for 5 or 6 months, and the three people that were working for us weren't paid a penny. But that decision paid off, because after month 7, we signed our second client who paid us quite a lot of money, and suddenly we were incredibly profitable overnight. So it's some of those decisions you make that are good in the long term, but maybe the short term seem bit tricky to make, i.e. not to do consulting, because we could have all gone back to banking and done consulting jobs, but we decided to build a product.
Yeah. You told me quite modestly the other day that one of the interesting journeys that you'd never expected is in the early days when you get clients, and probably the same for you, Ben, in the early days when you're starting to open shops, everything's massive and everything's a big bottle of champagne moment, as it rightly should be, like massive pat on the back to anyone that can actually successfully set something up that then makes a profit. But as you get bigger and you hire more people and you obviously need more clients, or in your case, Ben, more customers and more shops, do you find that some of that wears off a bit? Like, do the celebrations get smaller? Nice problem to have, I admit, but have you found that it's suddenly become more of a way of life now?
I mean, certainly, as long as everybody's incentivizing the company for success, it's a great feeling when you sign a deal, but there's nothing to describe the first years or months of your business when you suddenly go from having zero money to a little bit of money to quite a little bit, a lot more money. So it's quite... You know, I don't think Steve Jobs was as excited about his 19th product as he was about his iPhone. You know, it's quite difficult to keep that level of passion up. But, I mean, you know, we do it, and that's why we carry on.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think the problem sometimes with maybe being a founder or an entrepreneur is you're always thinking about the next thing. So when you start thinking about your next big deal or your next opening, it's all very exciting. By the time it actually happens, you've already moved on and you're thinking about what you're doing next. Yeah. So it kind of sometimes can feel a little bit like an anticlimax. But that's partly just a result of the amount of time that you've probably spent working on it before it actually happened. I mean, things very rarely suddenly happen overnight when you only started thinking about them that day or that week. So normally it's the amount of time planning.
Can you remember the time, if there was one, that you went, oh, I'm never going back to the corporate world, that's it?
I've never really had a job, so I've always, one of my driving things has been like, who on earth would employ me, so I better make this work.
There's a lesson there for everyone. How disenfranchised you are. Yes, you are, and that's why you need to be on your own and do it properly. Yeah, what about you? Because you were very much in the corporate world.
I never worked for a bank per se, but I've always worked in financial services. So, yeah, it's a comforting thought, and that definitely kept me through many, many cold nights of the soul, where I thought, oh, well, I can always walk back into a banking job or a software job. But I think after about a year, when you start to see the initial traction, you basically cancel that idea that you never will. It's a nice thing to have in your back pocket that if everything went wrong, you possibly could, but I think once you've committed to the lifestyle that you lead as an entrepreneur, that's the only thing you'll ever do again, because, you know, working for some faceless organization, you know, I don't mind a medium or small company, like less than 50 people, but as soon as you work for a company where there's more than a couple of hundred people and you don't know who the CEO is and you don't know why decisions are being made, you are basically a pawn in a big game, and I don't think anybody enjoys that.
Yeah. There is an inevitable part of a podcast that's all about business and startups, where you are asked to spread your advice to us young whippersnappers looking up at daddy and wanting a piece of daddy's pie. So what have you learned that could be passed on to anyone working here at Ministry of Startups or any other startup venture?
If you're young, don't do it. No, if you're young, do it. But there's something definitely lovely about somebody who's worked all their life in corporate, shall we call it, who's eventually gone to work for a startup, to see their eyes light up and tears form in their eyes when they realize that there is no decision process, there isn't a budget approval process, that they can just do stuff. You know, that idea that, like, who should I ask about that? And it's like, just do it, there's no asking. And to see their,
yeah, but there's another side to that, isn't there? But there's the, God, I think I better have to clean this toilet because, well, no one else is going to do it.
Yeah, sure, that goes with it. But so when you get somebody fresh out of college and they think this is normal life, or this is business as usual, that you can just do all these things without 3 years of training or without having to do certifications, you know, I think there's something lost there. And certainly I would say that the more senior members of my team, i.e. those over 30 with a few grey hairs, they absolutely get what a startup offers as opposed to a kind of corporate. So there is an element of definitely do a little bit of time in the corporate world. It's not a must, but it will definitely kind of get your head around you know, what's good and what's bad.
Yeah.
You know, when you wake up and go into work and you realize there might be shit happening, but this is actually okay, this is cool, versus this is shit and I really hate my life kind of bad, which you get in most corporates.
You said you were self-funded, but there was times when you didn't have any money and nor did any of your staff.
Yeah, I mean,
how do you get through that without waking up in a cold sweat?
I mean, that's definitely one decision people need to make, and we're obviously very proudly bootstrapped, and I wouldn't do it any other way. But you know, some businesses do need funding. The likes of, you know, Twitter and whatever wouldn't have really got anywhere without funding. But
yeah,
certainly, I think the decision to make B2B, i.e. selling to another company versus trying to sell a software or something at a lowish price to consumers. You know, in B2B, it's slightly clearer. You have to put on a suit and go talk to another organization to try and convince them to buy your product. That's kind of easily doable, in the sense of you can get a list of names together and go knock on their doors and sell to them. Whereas in the consumer world, it's very, very unclear if it's going to succeed or not. And that's something that I made a clear choice, or my background led me to do B2B. And therefore the bootstrapping thing wasn't a huge problem, because it meant one customer equals profitability.
Any other tip heads?
Don't be afraid to clean the toilet.
Yeah.
I mean, that is something true that, you know, I don't think any entrepreneur that you see the Social Network and you think it was all pool parties. No, there was an awful lot of coding. There was an awful lot of doing things yourselves. I mean, somebody who's worked in vaguely corporate, I always had a HR person, I always had a legal person, I always had somebody to do stuff, and suddenly as you're a founder, it's your job.
Yeah.
There isn't anybody that you can say, can you do this for me? It's like, no, it's you.
Buck stops with you. Yeah. Ben O'Brien, I'm going to make it very quick because I know you've got to scoot off. No pressure or anything, just give us all your advice on everything you've ever learned in your life quickly.
I think to some extent you just do it. You learn as you go along, and you learn more from your mistakes than your successes, which is the old adage that we all fear never actually is going to happen. But I suppose the only useful bit of advice I can give is, if you can put a bit of cash to one side such that you could work for a year without earning any money, I'd say that's like a huge advantage, because then you don't have to perhaps make too many compromises.
Yeah.
But other than that, just crack on and do it, really.
Get her done. Ben O'Brien from Sourced Market. He sells top quality sexy foods in train stations. Find out more at sourcedmarket.com. It's not just train stations, is it?
High Street as well.
Yeah. Didn't like my synopsis, really, of your top quality sexy foods in stations. It sounds rubbish.
I haven't used sexy in the description before,
Be honest. You're welcome. You can have that. And fundapps.co is Andrew White's company. And you can find out more at fundapps.co. He sells top quality sexy software, compliance software. And Ben, who runs this here Ministry of Startups. Hello, mate.
What's up?
What do you think about our first podcast?
I think it's pretty good. I think we learned a lot.
Yeah. I think the key is, and I'm synopsizing ridiculously, but there's a lot of just do it, get it done, isn't there?
Yeah, because if you don't do it, no one else is going to do it. So you just fill in the gap, really, aren't you?
I worked for a company once who... I was a graphic designer and they built websites, and he said to me, it took us 5 days of meetings to come up with our name. And by the way, it folded 2 years later.
Double times.
You'd love to be in that meeting for 5 days. Anyway, Andrew and Ben, thanks very much for coming in. Always a pleasure, never a chore. Bye bye for now.
Cheers.
Happy days.
Founders Ramble. Stories from entrepreneurs, how they started, why they started, where they're going next. Brought to you by the Ministry of Startups.